You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Good morning, everybody. Could I encourage you to take a seat and we'll get started? My name is Homi Karas. I'm the co-director of the Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings. And I wanted to welcome all of you today to talk about hunger on World Food Day. I know that many of you have been following the discussions last week around the annual meetings of the World Bank and the IMF. And there was a great deal of talk, but very little of that talk, I have to say, was actually about hunger and things that directly affect individual lives. So we thought it was useful to really try to focus on that aspect. What I'm going to do is give you a very quick overview of some facts and then invite a panel up here so that we can have a discussion about some of the issues that come on. So as a stock taking, doesn't look like I'm going to do anything. This doesn't work. Arrows don't work.
Just do it manually right here. Do it on there.
What? Nothing works. All right, so the basic message that I wanted to give is actually quite straightforward. It is that the world is really off track to end hunger. It for the first time in a very long time, the number of undernourished people actually went up rather than going down. It now stands at somewhere just over 800 million people who are undernourished by FAO data. The promise is to get that to zero by 2030 so that you can tell that there's a fair way to go. If you look at other indicators like stunting, you see some modest decline. But if we take the rate of change of stunting and say how long would it take us to get to zero, it would be 42 years. So we have to do something to, accelerate the rate of change. And when you look at what's actually happening to agricultural productivity and food production in many of the poor countries, you see that it's flat. And you still have 65 countries in the world where cereals production is less than 2 tons per hectare. At less than 2 tons per hectare, you're basically just eking out survival. So hopefully just in time, there's a pretty picture that I wanted to show you. And here's the thanks so much. Here's the picture. You know, this is a Gallup poll data. Not there? At least it's here, you know. Yay. So it's Gallup poll data. They've been asking the same question for a decade or more about whether you have, whether there have been times in the last 12 months when people didn't have enough money to buy food that they needed. And what you see, obviously, is that in low-income countries, it's somewhere around 60%. It's slightly less in middle-income countries at 30%. What's quite interesting to me is that even in advanced economies, it's also quite high. It's somewhere around 10%. Now, remember, there are about 1 billion people in advanced economies, so 10% means 100 million people going hungry in the rich countries of this world. So hunger is a universal thing. It is quite pervasive. And the thing I want you to take away from this picture is there is no evidence of any improvement over the last decade. I mean, the world has become considerably richer. The issues of hunger have not become appreciably smaller. So then there are a number of things on the policy side that we can look at to say, well, maybe there's just a lag, that policies are improving and things will get better in the future. So we looked at what FAO calls the Agricultural Orientation Index. It's moving in the wrong direction. We look at what's happening to food markets across the world. They're going in the wrong direction. More non-tariff barriers last year than before. We looked at what's happening to agricultural subsidies. They're still averaging something like upwards of $500 billion per year. It's an important number because it gives you a sense that this is not about just money. There is money being spent on these issues. It's just being spent in an extraordinarily inefficient way and a very untargeted way. And the only bright spot that we found was that there was a commitment made in Nairobi at the WTO ministerial for all advanced countries to eliminate their export subsidies on agricultural goods. In May, Australia became the first country to actually live up to that commitment, and as far as I know, the only country as yet. So here's a chart on what's happening to subsidies in the world, and what you see is that gradually and slowly, the OECD countries are actually reducing subsidies, but China, which is emerging as a major player in world food markets, has ramped up its level of subsidies enormously. So you add the two together, you're still at levels which are upwards of 500 million, as I said before. And then we took a look at resources. The biggest resource for agriculture is private credit. And there is now data on some 70-plus developing countries. Private credit for agriculture is flat. In those countries where we do have money on government spending, it's actually going down, not up. When we look at ODA, there's maybe some slight increase in commitments and disbursements, but it's very, very modest in scale. When you look across countries, those little dots are needs. The bars are the amounts that are actually being spent on food and nutrition security as a per person living in rural areas. We focus on rural areas because this is where the problems are most grave. And what you see is they vary enormously. So you've got a whole range of countries where in total, public, private, everything, they're spending less than $10 per year per person on food and nutrition security. I submit at that kind of level, you're very unlikely to see any change. And then you see a number of countries which are actually making progress, but they're spending $300, $200, $300 and upwards per person per year. And they are seeing some significant improvements. And so I just want you to think about the contrast between these two numbers because it gives you some sense of the degree of scale that might be needed in order to change these trajectories. So the takeaways, we've got a massive problem. It's getting worse. Policies haven't improved. Resources are flat at best. When you look internationally, what you see is that as food prices have started to come down from their peak, so has donor commitment, meaning their aid, going to food and nutrition security. So it looks as if nobody's actually really worrying about this problem. And we've got some thoughts about how you improve accountability. We think it starts with better data You know, I would say that unfortunately we still have data that is constantly being being revised, that is several years out of date. People aren't even trying to use modeling frameworks to get to the most recent availability. Governments have plenty of food and nutrition security strategies. It's not that they lack for strategies. And in some of the case studies that you can pick up and that's on our Ending Rural Hunger website, you'll see this listing of, you know, in some instances, four, five, six different strategies. But it seems to be the strategy for every moment. Some donor asks for a strategy. There's something called the Zero Hunger Challenge or Initiative. Here's a strategy for that. Something called CADEP. Here's a strategy for that. They're not integrated. They're not followed through. They're not implemented in any systematic way. And when it comes to developed countries, the last commitments they made was at the G7 in L'Aquila. Those expired in 2010. And since then, no commitments, therefore no accountability. So there's no commitments on money. There was a very vague statement by the G7 and Germany at Schloss Elmau saying we're going to help 500 million people, lift 500 million people out of hunger, but no action plan. So what does one make of that kind of statement? So that seems to me to be a little bit of where we actually are today. And now I'd like to invite our panel to come up, join me on the stage, and we'll have a bit of a conversation about it. Thank you very much. As they come up, let me introduce them. John MacArthur. John is a senior fellow here at Global. He was heavily involved in the Millennium Development Goals, now on the Sustainable Development Goals. And has been doing some work on Canada as an example of how even in developed countries these issues are pertinent, and of course is a co-author of the note that we produced on this stock-taking. On the far end is Asma Latif. Asma is the director at Bread for the World. This is an institution, it's probably the principal institution, which is advocating for U.S. leadership on food and nutrition security. The U.S. has historically been a leader in this space amongst advanced economies with a signature program of the last administration called Feed the Future. The U.S. was passed a Global Food Security Act that integrated nutrition and resilience and other kinds of things into their programs last year. And maybe we'll talk a bit about the impact of that kind of legislation, which also will need to be renewed at some point in the not-too-distant future. Next to her is Paul Winters. Paul is the Vice President of the Strategy and Knowledge Department of the International Fund for Agricultural Development. IFAD is one of the Rome-based agencies that actually invests in food and nutrition security. It is the principal long-term investor in these areas outside of the World Bank Group, but it's the only agency that is explicitly focused on the long-term issues of food and nutrition security. IFAD is now producing annual reports, the last one coming out of Paul's shop, and the last one was called Fostering Inclusive Rural Transformation. They are very much an organization that has emphasized the transformation of rural areas as part of this program. And closest to me is Irusalam Siba. Irusalam is a fellow in the Africa Growth Initiative, which is part of Global here at Brookings, and Irusalam has been coordinating all of the country case studies of African countries that we've included in our project. So thank you all very much for being here. Asmar, I wanted to start with you and start by, you know, first asking you, do you at Bread for the World actually share this rather dismal prognosis of where we stand? And are there any bright lights that you see, things that can give us some hope for optimism in the future? Or is your message also that things are really not going all that well and are actually getting worse in many areas?
Thank you very much for having me and for having this event on World Food Day. It's really exciting to see everyone here. Generally, Bread for the World has been quite optimistic about the progress that's been made. In 1990, one in four people on the planet was hungry, and that's down to one in nine. So that's not something we should take for granted. It's significant progress. But over the last several years, we have been, as we think about the SDG agenda, SDG and achieving SDG 2, it has pushed us to really focus on how do we accelerate progress? Because the people who are suffering from hunger now are living in much more difficult situations, and the challenges are much harder to overcome. And over the last year, you know, the issue of conflict has become much more visible. So the challenges are really that in the next several years, the majority of the world's hungry people will be living in fragile contexts. So that does mean that we need to do things very differently. In the U.S. context, the U.S. has been a leader, and there is strong bipartisan support for global food security. The Global Food Security Act passed with very strong support on both sides of the aisle. Funding levels have increased, were bumped up after the food price crisis, but they're certainly not where they need to be. And the current budget proposed to slash funding for food security and nutrition. So there is one of the things that sort of emerging, and you know, through the Global Food Security Act, the bipartisan support, I think you will find strong bipartisan support to continue to fund these activities moving forward, perhaps not at the levels, but we are definitely helping shore up the champions on the Hill and really encouraging that they don't cut these programs. And there are a few other bright spots, if you will. The new administrator of USAID, his first trip right after he was sworn in, was to the countries that are in near famine conditions. And I think, you know, that sends a very strong signal about his priorities. And he's also been talking a lot about helping countries transition. And so I think there's an opportunity really to situate these issues, food security, nutrition, in terms of how do you, in terms of being foundational to countries transitioning out of aid. You're investing in the human capacity of the country that is critical then to a proper and sustainable transition out of aid. So, you know, I think those are really important conversations that Mark Green has initiated, and I think as a development community, a food security and nutrition community, we really need to engage that and position food security and nutrition as being central to that long-term goal. Governor Beasley is now the head of the World Food Program. We've got now a very vocal and energetic champion for SDG 2. Who is, you know, former governor of South Carolina. And I think he can speak to the Republican members of Congress, this administration, in ways that perhaps the rest of the development community may not be able to. So I think, you know, there are some opportunities. It is the challenges are huge, and you're really right to point to the hurdles ahead. And I think we need to think about doing things differently. Every dollar that we invest has to be playing multiple roles. And I think we're not still, while we have a multi-sectoral global food security strategy, we've got a multi-sectoral nutrition strategy at AID, whole of government nutrition coordination plan here in the US that is really looking at resilience and nutrition and agriculture and gender, but operationalizing that and really making it meaningful integration at the country level, at the community level, I think those are where some of the challenges remain.
Okay, but let me, you talked about Mr. Beasley, who's the head of the World Food Program. But the World Food Program is really it's a humanitarian organization. And to some extent, you know, I wonder whether we're falling into the trap of thinking about food and nutrition security just as humanitarian relief. I mean, we want to stop people from starving to death, obviously. Mm-hmm. But if we just treat those symptoms, we're never going to get out of this, you know, recurring set of crises, et cetera. What about the long-term investments in the transformations that people talk about?
I think that is a risk with the spotlight focused on these four countries and potentially more countries coming online. That is a risk, but I think it really behooves us, given that we have a framework that is much more than humanitarian. I mean, we've got a framework that looks at the long-term development pieces as well as the humanitarian. We have to get better at bridging. And one of the things I found a bit heartening is seeing FAO, IFAD, and the World Food Program all engaged in this conversation about what to do in these four countries. And I think Graziano da Silva has made the point that if we don't help people in those countries who are, to plant for the next harvest now, we will have a much more expensive humanitarian effort next year. And so I think we have to think differently about bridging that gap between humanitarian and development and really helping most of the people affected by these near-famine conditions are in rural areas. And so how do we get smarter about the kind of assistance we give them and not just airdrop food, but help them wherever they are, if they're displaced or whatever. You know, they have the skills and help them get back on their feet more quickly.
Jerusalem, let me come to you because, you know, you coordinated a number of country case studies. None of them were in the crisis countries. And what was slightly shocking to me was to see, you know, we all know that we do have food and famine or near famine conditions in a number of countries, and there's this sense, well, maybe that's driving this global data that we see. But actually, in every one of the country case studies that looked at, you also see no evidence of any progress at all. I mean, this is a deep structural problem in many, many countries.
First of all, thank you for giving me the chance, not just to sit here, but also to give me the opportunity to. I think.
Yeah,
so.
But it's a bit.
You gotta speak up.
Okay, speak up. Okay. Thank you for this opportunity, but also for letting me speak to the experts on the ground to know the on-the-ground challenge they're facing in achieving food security, food and nutrition security. We started this project by looking at the desk work. And so almost all the countries we looked at, Nigeria, Senegal, Tanzania, Uganda, and Ethiopia. Except for Nigeria, one of the major challenges they are facing is agricultural productivity gap. And then we looked at, so which of the countries who are more food secure, what are their characteristics? And we found mostly that those countries who are focused on improving their productivity are actually managing well in terms of achieving better food and nutrition security. But there are differences, disparities within a society. Other than improving agricultural productivity, we found that children, women, most importantly food producers, are highly affected by food and nutrition security. Of course, conflicts affected in unstable country, regions of country, they are always negatively and highly affected by food and nutrition security issues. So it's not really enough to address productivity gaps. Even those who manage to improve their productivity within these countries we oversaw, malnutrition is the next biggest challenge. So, for example, the country I closely looked at, Ethiopia, there are regions who are food secure, but not necessarily nutritionally secure. So it was surprising for us to find that actually food producers are the most affected by malnutrition and issues with diversity of food consumed. So the, really the takeaway message we found from these studies is not, it's not just farm-based interventions that work, but also holistic approach and also looking at the entire value chain of the agriculture, not just the farm, but where are the markets, are they functioning, are there market failures? Do farmers have, for example, storage capacity to store their produce in times of excess production and then sell it when prices are higher? So do they have the information or the know-how where to find, where to locate their markets? And also, for example, urban consumers or those who buy their foods tend to be more secure than food producers in rural countries. So some of these issues, in addition to resilience issues, environmental shocks, we need to think about how to structurally transform the agriculture sector. So based on the discussions I had with on the ground stakeholders, so there is like a wish on the ground from these people that agriculture is transformed from subsistence to driven by a sector driven by entrepreneurs. And most seem to agree that farmers are the real risk takers, the ultimate risk takers and entrepreneurs of these countries. So we need to have a paradigm shift, a change of mindset from thinking farmers as like recipients of subsidies, aids, and many other handouts, into a market or a sector where these are ultimate entrepreneurs and risk takers, and we need to support them in terms of insuring them against shocks and things like that.
Fine, but if you want to have that kind of transformation, you probably also need some kind of investment. And all of these countries have signed on to the Malabo Declaration. They've all committed themselves to spend 10% of the budget on food and nutrition security. And none of them are even approaching half that level. So, you know, it's one thing to, talk about this, it's something else to actually implement. What's the sense of, you know, why is it that despite commitments at the leaders' level in all of these countries, nothing really seems to change, at least in terms of public investments in agriculture and rural roads, in warehousing, all the things you talked about?
So I want to shift this the discussion on resource from the total resources spent either by the national governments or the bilateral donors to really think about first the composition of the resource, the share of the the resource? Where are they coming from? Is it from the government itself or from external sources matter? So just to give you an example, Senegal is one of the countries with the highest intensity in terms of resource spend and financed by the public, the government itself. But they are not necessarily the lowest in terms of needs, if you look. So some of the argument there is we need to think about inefficiencies, how we spend the resources, and also where we spend them. Is it on subsidy or is it on long-term issues, addressing long-term issues in agriculture? Ghana, for example, is a country we saw where most of the food and nutrition security agenda is driven by external resources. So their challenge there is that now that they are graduating to low middle income countries, they need to figure out how to resource mobilize to mobilize their resources within their own means. It seems to be the case that those projects, programs funded by external sources, they seem to perform better. But scaling up those successful projects is going to be a challenge if the national government itself is not going to scale up and fund those projects. So the trend is when the agenda, the food and nutrition security agenda, is mainly driven by national resources, we see that the policies are also performing well in terms of agricultural policies, enabling condition for women, rural assistance. They tend to go hand in hand with national resources spent on food and nutrition security. On the other hand, the higher the share of the external resources, we see that these countries perform better, for example, in rural assistance and nutrition security. So even among these countries which are relatively more successful, it seems to be the case that nutrition security, even when they address the food security, the agriculture and transformation, is going to remain. And that's also mainly because of awareness issues and diversification and things like that. So beyond the total resource spent, we need to think about the share of resource, the composition, and also to monitor the investments. Okay. Are they making any impact?
Okay. Yeah. So, Paul, I think that, a couple of challenges for you as an external agency. One is, how do you actually get the country ownership and make sure that policies are right? And second, how do you actually scale up? And, IFAD is, it's a large organization, but it's not a massive organization in terms of its investments, and you're faced with a massive problem and challenge. How do you get to scaling up?
So so for those that don't know IFAD, we are an international financial institution, but we only focus on targeted programs for basically the rural poor. So we loan to governments, but very targeted agricultural programs, rural development programs. And this is the challenge that we face. We see that the problem is enormous, that we need to do something about it. And we need to have more resources put into this problem. And I must say, up until recently, when the SDGs came out, we knew all these challenges, but it didn't really lead to any sort of change within the institution. We wrote papers that showed that we were linked to these things, but without doing anything proactive. That's changed this year, and that's largely for two reasons. One is we have a new president that came in and he's the Gilbert Hombo. He's the former prime minister of Togo, worked with ILO, UNDP, and he has a different view of things that are much more results-oriented. And the other, maybe even more important, is that we're out getting more money. It's a replenishment year for IFAD, and so the donors are putting tremendous pressure on us, asking us, what are we going to do differently? And so to answer that question, I think I can describe it in three parts. The first is that historically, a lot of our operations, our loans, really just drove what we did. We would have policy dialogue or discussions with government. Our country strategies were largely based around, we're going to give you this loan in livestock or in irrigation. And we didn't think of it in terms of the broader landscape in which we're working. The new president came back from Southern Africa, and I was meeting with him right afterwards. And he was talking to our country program manager in Zambia and asked what role we had in the national policy dialogue. And the answer was absolutely nothing, that we talked only about our individual operations. So the first thing that we're doing is changing that. And we're changing the way that we interact within our countries to make it much more focused on the policy dialogue drives what we do in our operations rather than our operations driving the policy dialogue. This means more decentralization of our organization. So that's something that we just firmed up the plans last week. But it also means changing the way in which we interact with government. More partnerships with other organizations working within the country, and generally focusing much more on the engagement with the country. That brings me to the second change, and that's leveraging more resources. At the global level, right now we're almost entirely driven by ODA. What we are trying to move towards is more borrowing. So we're borrowing sovereign borrowing, concessional partner loans, and then ultimately we hope to build towards market borrowing. Now, we have all these resources, so if you donate a dollar to EFAD, it would be much better if that was worth $1.50, because we could go out and borrow against the money that's constantly coming in. And this is what IDA has done with their resources, and we're able to greatly expand their resources. So if you think from a taxpayer's point of view, if I'm going to be giving money, it would be much better if it was leveraged in some way. And so we can do that leveraging. We're also under tremendous pressure to give more to lower-income countries, lower-middle-income countries. And by borrowing, we can leverage our own resources and focus those much more on upper-middle-income countries, the borrowed resources that can be put on ordinary terms. Then also that leveraging at the national level, to work more with governments to get them to co-finance more on our loans, to do reimbursable technical assistance. We have Saudi Arabia, Botswana, and Chile right now talking to us about providing technical assistance in their own projects where we'll help target that. So it's their resources that are being used, but getting more co-financing with other institutions as well. So the second thing is really trying to leverage. We have ODA. How can we make that become bigger by leveraging these other resources? And then the third thing that we're really changing is much more focus on results. So the SDGs have been laid out there, and as I said at the beginning, we were primarily writing papers that showed what we really did. That we did matches these in the hope that that would be good enough. But we really need to think in terms of every single project that we put in. How is it mapping into those the first two SDGs in rural areas? That's our focus. What is the theory of change, the investment that we do in each of these, and how does it actually link up to those? And are we actually measuring it in our project, in every project? So we created a development effectiveness framework that is improving our M&E systems within the project, so collecting data within the projects. And then we're doing impact assessments of 15% of our projects. So that's a rigorous, where you have a counterfactual estimate of whether our projects have an impact or not. And very much trying to use that to learn lessons and to push forward. So what we're given the enormity of the problem, it's basically a combination of trying to get bigger, but also to be better and smarter in what we're doing.
So those are, you know, improvements, and any organization, of course, can always strive to improve. But are we going to get to the targets, the SDG targets? I mean, how much change do you need to do in order to really get us there?
Well, it requires a combination of those two things, right? It requires more resources be put into it, and we do better at using those resources. Mm-hmm. And are we going to get the targets depends on how much more resources we have and whether we can continuously improve. I was meeting with the Gates Foundation last week, and they have this SDG 2.3 roadmap that they put out. So one of the things over the next 4 or 5 years they're trying to do is gather evidence. So what they're trying to do is mirror what's been done in health and nutrition, in which they start by gathering evidence, and then they go to start coming up with metrics that show how things work, that where we're trying to get to, and then trying to get donors to work together to work towards those goals. But this is what we broadly need to do, right, is gather the evidence, try to get coalitions of people willing to work together and drive towards those particular goals.
So if we take this fundamental problem that we've got, I don't know, 65 or so countries where levels of average levels of productivity are just miserably low, and that means that for many individuals within those countries, actual productivity yields are even lower. What are we going to do to make them into modern farming enterprises?
Well, it requires investing in technology and all of the things that we know we need to do, and in which the technologies are largely available. A lot of it's a problem of access, and there was a discussion of some of the policies that are being used, and many of them don't make any sense. There's a lot of fertilizer subsidies being happening in sub-Saharan Africa, which require huge amounts of budget but are actually not changing productivity. You're handing fertilizer and you can get higher yields from that, but it's really not altering the fundamental nature of the agriculture. And those kind of funds could be used in a better manner to increase productivity. So I think we know what to do. It's just we're not doing it, and the commitment of governments is not there enough to try to push forward things that increase that productivity.
John, you've written a lot about fertilizer, and do you agree that fertilizer subsidies are not the way to go? If we don't subsidize fertilizer, how are we going to get farmers to use more of it and increase their productivity?
You know, I'm sitting here, Homi, and our job is to be kind of sober analysts at Brookings, but part of me wants to pull my hair out because this is... I'm looking at John Conrad in the front row. You know, this conversation is so tiresome at a basic level. The fact that we're still having this conversation is pretty brutal. Let's just be honest. So, yes, there is progress happening on a global level in the big picture in the grand sweep of history. But the ratio of kind of conversation and policy effort to outcomes is so out of whack. And the resources are so absent compared to what's needed. And our bottom line here is the accountability is basically non-existent. And so, you know, the details of fertilizer policy, you know, there's one issue, which is there are a lot of places that do fertilizer subsidies badly. There's another issue, which is that there's no country that's had a takeoff in the 20th century of agricultural productivity without a fertilizer subsidy. So you got to be smart about it. You can't be silly about it. That's like a lot of policies, you know, with utmost respect. You can do a bad policy, no question. But why don't we get smart about it? And so I just preparing for this, I was thinking, you know, there's some concepts just to reflect a little bit that we need to keep in mind, which I would say have moved forward. There's some basic facts, and then there's the need for a bit of inspiration. So on concepts, you know, I did a pretty deep dive in the economics literature about a dozen years ago to say, let's just look at what we know in the field of economics about the role of agriculture and green revolutions in economic growth. Roughly speaking, it was an empty set. The literature had basically skipped that topic for a generation. And there were a few people doing things here and there, Alain de Genvry, you know, François Bourguignon, people had done some things, so you can give an exception to everything, but as a basic premise, it was absent in the literature for a generation. We have seen a lot of progress in the literature over the past generation. People like Luke Christensen at the bank done terrific work showing how, you know, the returns to investment in agriculture, if you want to end extreme poverty, higher than most other things you can look at. You know, we had the proliferation of randomized control trials, which lo and behold showed that people who use fertilizer get higher yields. And lo and behold, there's a demand curve and really poor people don't use fertilizer because they can't afford it. So we have more and more evidence on this. And that's actually good. And I was in Uganda, I remember in 2005 with senior officials talking about the need to invest in smallholder agriculture with subsidies for things like fertilizer and seeds. And this was heretical at the time. I was there this summer with the same officials, different context, they were talking about their latest paper on efficient subsidies for fertilizer. So you can see how, you know, just papers, but you can see how the conversation has evolved. I also remember, very clearly, I was at TCAD in Yokohama in 2008 in the middle of the world food price crisis, and Prime Minister Meles was basically berating the world and other world leaders for not doing anything for the upcoming planting season. I had never seen anything like it. An African leader basically holding other leaders to account for not doing anything going into the crisis planting season. And this was the politics that led to GAFSPI. Now, GAFSPI, does it go really at
global
scale?
Global Agriculture and Food Security Program.
Does that operate at what anyone considers global scale? So it's global in the name, but how many things have global in the first word but aren't global? A lot. And how many people think it's rapid response based on the upcoming planting season in each country? I don't know many. So these concepts are not fleshing through the system into practicality. And again, that's not just to be clear. There's a lot of progress in places like EFED, like WFP, the bank too. But we're not at the scale of practicality. So when we look, we're now at a stage where we have the World Bank has set a target. I'm just going to single out the World Bank to, because it drives me crazy sometimes. World Bank has set a target to end extreme poverty at least 3% by 2030. Okay, so what does that mean in each country? Is that 3% of the world or 3% of each country? It should be 3% of each country in order to be serious, or else we're going to say, okay, it's fine for Nigeria and DRC to have that extreme poverty, just a couple hundred million people over there. That's roughly what we're on track for right now. So if we're going to be 3% for each country, what's the agricultural strategy for each country? Because we know in those countries, agriculture will be central to ending extreme poverty and ending hunger, because those things are connected. So why don't we have the 3% target implemented for hunger and poverty in each country? And why don't we have that be a centerpiece of each multilateral organization's policy advice to that country? Where even if the resources aren't available, because EFED needs more money. They can't do it on their own without more money. And one of the big challenges is, we looked at this with the financial flows, the largest multilateral financing flows for food nutrition security are going through organizations for which food nutrition security is not the number one priority. So it gets squeezed out in attention. So how do we give attention at the practical level as a concept? I think that's got to be a centerpiece. Now, just to hold others to account for a moment, recently FAO put out this very disturbing data showing that, as we reference here, undernourishment has gone up about 50 to 60 million people. Owen Barter, I tweeted this, Owen Barter, head of Center for Global Development in London, said, is this a real number? Do we know? Is this a strong number or a weak number? And I said, I'd love a confidence interval, but let's ask FAO data, at FAO data. Please explain. No answer. This is public. How can that be? How can we not even understand the data with clarity to within 50 to 60 million people at a time? That's not okay either. Our data, and this is one of our key messages, the data systems need to be better so we're at least honest in how much we know. If we still don't know, let's just say we need to know. Let's not pretend we know. But I also want to talk about, I'll hold my home country to account for a moment, Canada. So Canada just put out a, before we put this up, actually, please hold that for a sec. Canada just put out its new international assistance strategy, feminist international assistance policy. As part of the Ending Rural Hunger Project, we had a professor based in the UK look at the history of Canada's food nutrition security strategies. Turns out one of the great achievements of the Harper government was to really consolidate its efforts on food nutrition security. But then he looked at the latest strategy, the feminist policy, and said, wow, it's not really clear what's happening there. What's the continuity? And food and nutrition security is central for a feminist policy. So where's that continuity? Then we looked, as Homi said, at the domestic. Now we can look at this one. So this is a universal challenge, of course. This is the advanced economies, too. This is data from Carol Graham, who's our colleague here, and looking at the Gallup data. This is the survey of food insecurity in Canada. This is self-described food insecurity, the same graph that Homi showed before for the world. And this is over the past decade. And roughly speaking, it's going up. It's certainly not going down. So we do have a global challenge. And this is probably better measured than anything else because it's self-assessed. But even Canada isn't there yet. It's got about 10% of the population, about 3.5 million people, food insecure. That's not okay either. So after that, it's a bit doomsday, but it's not doomsday. It's just trying to be honest about where we stand. So let me show share a flip side. This morning on my way here, I got the most inspiring email of the week for sure. It was Lauren Bush Lauren sending out her 10-year anniversary email. Some of you might know Lauren Bush Lauren started 10 years ago today, basically, a feed. It's a social venture that supports school meals, originally with WFP around the world, and also now in America, in the US. 10-year anniversary, they announced today, they've supported 100 million school meals. One person, one company, a team, obviously, but said, let's actually use social marketing in effect. It's a fashion company that supports school meals. 100 million. She's holding herself accountable. That she is role modeling accountability to take on rural hunger through very creative means. So I am of the view, as much as this feels a little bit Groundhog Day in having these conversations, because I'm just being very frank here, I do think that there are many seeds of breakthrough that could bend the curve towards much faster progress from the private sector and the public sector and the multilateral institutions, but we need to be very honest that we're roughly an order of magnitude off right now if we're going to have a chance of getting there. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, that was both... not quite sure what that how that left me.
I think it's called a feeling, rant. You know?
But it did make me actually come back to Asma, because at the end of the day, at least part of what you're saying is, we have to change things. We have to make some noise. We have to have better advocacy, and this is what you've been doing, Asma, for so how are we gonna change and have a breakthrough in the advocacy and the accountability? And does it help us to link the global issues with the domestic issues, or is that a wedge where people say, no, we've got problems at home, let's take care of those first, and then we can take care of problems overseas? Where do you stand right now on some of these issues?
To achieve the SDGs, we have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. So I think there's, I think, yes, there is a political moment and politics right now that is saying we can't do both. We have to focus on domestic versus. But I think, that's a false argument, and we have to really push back. And clearly, the benefits of prosperity in developing countries are felt here as well. So we have to really make that case. You know, a lot of what's been said is really focused on political will. I mean, it is, there is the accountability piece, and of course civil society and others can push for that accountability. But it is political will, and for whatever reason, we as a community have not been able to make the case that agriculture, food security, and nutrition are foundational investments in health and productivity. I think even in this country, the Farm Bill is completely separate from the health outcomes of the average American. That there's a disconnect. And we haven't made that connection clearly enough. We have to really be able to point to the evidence and make that case that these investments have a very high return on investment. We're not being heard around, except for amongst ourselves. And we all really get it. So I think we really do need to find ways to talk. I mean, even on nutrition, the evidence is so clear. 16-to-1 return on investment for the Lancet interventions. We haven't been able to get the kind of money to scale up those, and it's not a lot of money in the grander scheme of things. Mm. It's a very small amount of money. So we have got to somehow find ways of talking about these issues that appeal to finance ministers, that appeal to bankers. That's where the power lies, and that's where we need to have an impact.
So, Paul, I mean, you've been having these replenishment discussions, et cetera. You put this kind of evidence presumably on the table, but my understanding is you're not getting the kind of response that you might really want. So what else can be done? I mean, what do people say when you say we have these opportunities and you're just, you know, leaving them on the table?
But I was going to comment anyway, following up on what was just said, is that because I've spoken a lot with donors, especially Europeans, in the last couple months, and I think it's less political will as political reality. The governments of Europe, at least, they want to spend money on anything that's going to stop migration or deal with migration, and so the funding that organizations like ours, and we were told IDA faced the same thing, is that you have to sell yourself as dealing with fragile situations in the hope that you're going to stem migration.
So is that why the FAO have just put out something saying all of the hunger thing is actually going to stop migration?
The emphasis on that part, mm-hmm. I think, is largely political. That within Europe, there is an obsession with migration issues and a desire to put funds towards migration within the country or stemming it from where it's coming from. And I do think that is a reality that we have to face. While you make the arguments about the long term, and they understand the arguments about the long term, the donors are telling us, you know, in private conversations, that this is the reality that they face back at home. And if they can't make the arguments for funding, they can only make the argument funding EFAD by making it part of a broader context of concern about migration issues. So it's really driven. We had two donors, one cut in half their pledges last time and one completely cut from our last replenishment in the middle of the cycle, even though they pledged it entirely to use the money for migration within the country. And so it's driving a lot of what's going on in the discussions.
Well, that's not terribly encouraging. Let me open it up a little bit and feel free to both ask questions and if you have any comments, thoughts, or advice as to how we can remedy this situation, I think that would also be welcomed. Can we have some? We'll take a few.
Great, thank you. I'm John Coonrod with the Hunger Project. I have a question for Dr. Seba. We've talked a lot about the accountability, sort of the top-down institutional government, and that makes sense because we're in Washington. But I'm really interested in the lack of voice of small-scale farmers with their own governments and in the ability to bridge that gap so that small-scale farmers can actually demand accountability from their own governments. And I'm just wondering, Doctor, in your case studies, you have some strong decentralizers and some weak decentralizers. Did you see any good examples of rural people gaining more demand over resources? I was also just in Uganda. Their districts' budgets have fallen in recent years rather than gone up. But you also looked at Wereda. So I'm just wondering what you saw in terms of the ability – of bottom-up pressure coming to bear on this?
Lady, right there. Well,
you don't want him to answer this question?
We'll take a few and then come back.
I'd like to ask a devil's advocate kind of questions. So if there's rural poor, then give them a bus ticket to the local big city, Nairobi, Mogadishu, whatever. Women's farming was, at least in Africa, historically women's work. So let ConAgra or Monsanto buy up the land, although there's not much property ownership in a lot of African countries where I've served. So why don't you fix it with realistic solutions? Bus ticket, let big agribusiness buy up the land and plant what they want.
Thank you. And there was somebody right here. Yeah.
My name is Mahesh Kavari. I teach at Cernedi Washington University, and my question is about global warming, climate change, and its effect on global agriculture and also food security, especially after what we see in Puerto Rico, that even in developing countries, we have a deal when it comes to distribution of food. Thank you.
Why don't we take these questions, and then we'll come back for another round. Asma, you want to start? Any of these?
Yes, I'll take the climate change question, because I was thinking that we had failed to mention that, and that was, so thank you for asking that question. It is already having an impact on agricultural yields. So the link between hunger and climate change is both direct and then indirect, in the sense that it is driving conflict and migration as people move because their land is, they're unable to grow crops where they are. So that is, I think, that makes it, compounds the challenge. Not only do we have to support and help farmers with traditional, just getting up to speed with traditional technologies, but now really integrating the whole idea of adaptation to climate change very much into everything we do, and resilience, and building resilience, because as you mentioned, we will never know where the shocks are coming from, and so people need to be able to rebound more quickly. So, yeah.
Paul, small-scale farmers, I thought you were supposed to represent them.
Actually, if you don't mind, I wanted to answer about the bus ticket first. To me, it's a fairly failed policy, and this is what was found in Latin America by Dejanvry and Sadulay a while back. When all you're doing is exporting poor people from rural areas to urban areas, and that's what a bus ticket does, right? All you're doing is taking poor people and moving them to urban areas. You haven't solved any sort of problems. And while we expect that a certain percent of people will move to urban areas, that makes perfect sense. There's opportunities in rural areas to get ahead through agriculture, through linked industries, linked agriculture. Part of the work that Luke Christensen and others have done is to show not only is agriculture the most poverty-reducing sector, but the non-agricultural sectors most closely linked to agriculture are the ones that are most poverty-reducing. And so as a sector for poverty reduction, it's quite effective, and it would be foolish to not recognize that that's the case. And as I said, we expect some sort of balance between areas, but we also don't want people to flee agriculture because they lack opportunities, because productivity is down, et cetera. So it's a missed opportunity just to give them a bus ticket. In terms of the smallholders and accountability, I mean, this is something that EFAD tries to work on. It is complicated, and a lot depends on the government context, as you said, about decentralization. One area that I think is very important is transparency, and something that we're just trying to do. We're a bit behind at our organization in being transparent. But if you're very clear about your projects and their objectives, and you put your project completion reports and the information out there, and you reflect back to the smallholders you're supposed to be helping, both in your projects and other government projects, then they have a better chance to have a voice and to say this is the right path or not. And so if we're all a bit more transparent on what we're doing within the field, then it would allow them to actually speak up. But right now, a lot of organizations and governments don't really talk about what their strategies are, don't say what they're doing, don't put the data out there that suggests success or not success. And so it makes it harder to have a voice when you have no information to have a voice about. So.
John?
I would just say that the fastest growing cities in the world are in Africa, in the countries with the lowest agricultural productivity. They're growing faster than the cities in China. They're already buying bus tickets. The problem is that they're leaving not because of great opportunity. They're leaving because of lack of opportunity. So this is not the structural transformation of success. This is closer to the Malthusian theorem of there's nothing, the low productivity rural areas, very small farms, no jobs in the city, but we're going to give it a go. So I actually want them to buy fewer bus tickets in those places because I'd like them to have more opportunity as a concept. Now, one of the things that's not adequately appreciated, and I'm going to speak in generalities because it depends very much on each economy, and IFPRI's done a lot of nice modeling on this, but roughly speaking, if you're thinking about the long-term well-being of the economy, improving the productivity in the local staple crops will basically make your exchange rate more competitive, your real exchange rate, which helps make your export sectors more competitive. One of the puzzles over time is why hasn't Africa developed more export sectors? That is probably, in my view, one of the biggest reasons, because they haven't had the agricultural productivity breakthrough to enable that. All the countries in Asia that had the manufacturing breakthroughs that we're used to talking about had the agricultural breakthrough first. So, The role of women in farming is still one of these areas where there's a lot more statements made than strong evidence, but that's starting to get a bit better, I would argue. But I would say that there's been a lot of papers in the past couple of years just saying, everything we thought about quote unquote women farmers, we need to kind of update our thinking on. So I would just, encourage that as a general point.
Devil's advocate to get you talking.
Well, happy to, very happy to. But I think it does get also to this point of whose voice do we listen to, which I think is the core of what John is getting at, which is absolutely right. In a lot of countries, the poorest people are the last ones to be listened to. In some countries, like Kenya, it's pretty good at mobilizing everyone right now, especially through mobile connectivity. So I think that's an unanswered question. In a lot of places, but a better and better answered question in some places. There's also this whole thing around, all the new jobs are being created in the service sector anyhow. Again, sometimes that's because of success, like what Luke Christensen's found. Sometimes it's because nothing's working, so that's all they can do. And so we always need to be unpacking why are these trends taking shape the way they are.
Small farmers directly at you.
Yes, sir, I think you pointed out, which I think is the most challenging task for governments of these African countries. We saw Ethiopia, for example, is one of the countries following this federal system. And one of the challenges there is resources being fragmented into three.
Could you speak up?
Yeah. So resource fragmentation, when some of these countries are having federal system, so it gets spread out from the national level to regions and lower level administration. So when it gets to the lower level of administrative levels, really it becomes almost impossible to address food and nutrition security when the resources are thinly sliced among the various administrative units we have. So just to give you an example, an NGO that I interviewed working on food security in Ethiopia, I asked them, what could be improved? What is the major challenge that you are facing as an international NGO based in Ethiopia? So the major challenge there is was lack of ownership. Even the projects in the areas rehabilitated by these NGOs will not be... So they get to be asked to rehabilitate those projects in the future. It's because of the lack of ownership of these projects after the completion of the NGO's tasks. We also raised this question to various stakeholders. What could be improved, for example, on the government side? They would say joint planning, accountability. So it's not blaming one ministry for something when things go wrong. If things are planned jointly, then they will be jointly accountable for the success or the failure of those projects. So which we found was interesting insight. So how are they addressing this issue of the lack of ownership of these projects? Some of them train the locals, the youth of the locals, so they have better ownership of these projects, and so they don't get asked to rehabilitate these projects or these areas that they worked on previously. Multilaterals also have, especially the ADB, have some roles to play in terms of influencing the resource distribution across the various affected areas. So if the distribution of resources agreed upon in advance, if they have a say on the way resources are distributed according to the needs of these countries, I think we will be better at in achieving the various disparities across different societies, different regions in some of the countries. So maybe finally on accountability, these indicators, from my own experience, they get the best attention of policymakers when we put them in comparative perspective. How is Ethiopia performing compared to the other countries? So this is the most attention you get from a policymaker when you put it in a comparative perspective. I think they play their role in terms of holding, at least making them more aware on the relative standing of their respective countries.
Okay, thank you. While the gentleman's getting the microphone, I can't resist just saying that there was an actual randomized control trial of bus tickets in Bangladesh. It proved to be a very successful development intervention. The problem, of course, is that 3.5 billion people in rural areas means an awful lot of bus tickets, so it's unclear that it can really go to scale. And the other part, just I think, which is interesting about the way the question is posed, is that it tells us that the real issue with food and nutrition security is not actually about how much food is being produced, letting Monsanto or whoever produce on that land. It's about the access of the individuals to the food and the affordability. And so I think we need to constantly come back to remind ourselves that this is a person. It's about people, not about aggregate production. Although obviously for small farm producers, productivity is their principal source of income levels.
Yeah, thank you so much for the panel. I've learned a lot this morning. I'm formerly the Associate Administrator of the Office of International Cooperation and Development at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That office has now been part of the Foreign Agricultural Service. So a lot of this discussion seems awfully familiar going back decades. Because this could be 1987 for all intents and purposes, but shows a lot of progress also. So my question is, our office did a lot of technical assistance. I didn't hear the word technical assistance, training of foreign agriculturalists. I remember a project in Cameroon on roots and tubers between the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, historically black college, and an institution in Cameroon that was wildly successful in terms of increasing yields, et cetera. So I was wondering if maybe one or more of the panelists could discuss what is the role of technical assistance? Is it falling out of favor? What about training of foreign agriculturalists? Does this make a difference? And I just am here to listen and learn. Thank you.
Or it's not on.
Thank you. Yang No-Yoon, our Foundation for Empowerment. Thank you very much for all inspiring and very tiresome discussions, I agree. I feel here, in some sense, very encouraging that the international community shows such an intense interest in rural hunger. On the other hand, I feel that we all hear about the political will or whatever from the international perspective. How about the political will of the country and their leaders while they were in their own country, not only coming to the international organization as the head of those organizations? So my question here is that basically from my experience in Africa and other places as a World Bank economist, I've seen very little political will of the government for the rural area anyway, but that's not only developing countries, everywhere in the world. So how to really promote the political will of the each and every country? That's my first question. My second question is that while you talk a lot about the agricultural productivity and the holistic approach of the rural development, I feel that I didn't hear land title issues such as land title issues and one problem with the small holding the land in already in 1990s, the smallholding agriculture land was a problem. One of the most important elements for low agricultural productivity. So I don't hear that kind of thing. Plus, actually, agricultural business, you talked about East Asia, such as China and in Korea, high agricultural productivity. High agricultural productivity was related to the agribusiness. For example, food processing or whatever in relation to the food or agricultural product they have produced. So as a person who is sort of one and a half generation of the people who really took the train ticket, not the bus ticket, that's how I went to Seoul and how I was growing up. That's my second question. Third, my last question is IFAD. You are talking about the IFAD and rural hunger and I'm asking whether North Korea, which has a big problem in rural hunger, is a part of your program or not. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Why don't we take those questions, and if you have any sort of final thoughts that you want to leave our audience with, just tack them on to the end of your answers to the questions. So again, let's just go straight down the row.
So I'll tackle the political will in developing countries. I think there is growing political will. There's a disconnect between spending, budget allocation, but if you look at the SDG agenda, I think it was the developing countries that really pushed for SDG 2, the hunger goal. And that's a pretty comprehensive goal. The Scaling Up Nutrition movement now has 60 countries that have signed up. Very little money yet to accompany that commitment from donors or countries, but there's a growing recognition that nutrition is really important to long-term economic outcomes. So I think we have to move to that next level of producing the resources that are needed, both domestic and ODA and multilateral. But we also need to really be engaging policymakers on being smart with those resources and not missing opportunities. And I think the other issue that we didn't really touch on is the issue of social protection. And how do you build social protection systems, even in rural areas, so that you can both support agriculture but also meet immediate needs to improve health and nutrition outcomes. And that, I think, is a policy conversation. It's a conversation about taking a very comprehensive approach, and that's going to require a lot of resources.
Paul?
On the North Korea question, that's an easy one. Yes, we actually do have a program there. It's suspended right now, mostly because they're the only country that has not paid us back for previous support. So it's in arrears presently, but we do have a program there. On the technical assistance question, to me, it's I think the question should be thought of in a different way. There's not an EFAD project across the board that does not have a technical assistance component. But to me, the interesting question is, what kind of technical assistance and where should be targeted? And the big question is staples versus other crops. And EFAD in general has moved away from staples. And this is one of the questions that I don't think we have the answer to, but is what is the best pathway out of poverty? Remember, we target. So we're not talking about broad expansion in agriculture productivity within a country. We're talking about what is going to transform the lives of this group of rural households and get them out of poverty. Should it be promoting roots and tubers? Or should it be promoting dairy production, which has a higher value in the market? Our answer has generally been the latter. And we've shifted very much towards products that can be marketable. And that can be roots and tubers. You can sell potatoes to Frito-Lay. There's a project in Ecuador that does that. But it generally is other crops besides that. And this is part of a debate that's going on. There's a paper written by Prabhu Pangali, who's at Cornell University, used to be at Gates and FAO, that basically says that the Consultative Group for International Ag Research, all those research centers out there, their fundamental problem is they're too fixated on staples, and they need to move into other crops. And for nutrition and for general transformation out of poverty, this is the way to go. And so to me, the technical assistance question isn't, yes, of course. I mean, that's productivity change. It's where should we focus that technical assistance, both to broadly include agricultural production, productivity, which is one question, but also the targeted programs. So I think that that's the big question we have to answer.
Thank you.
I'll just say, I think the political will I agree with, but don't agree with, because the thing about political will, I like political leadership as much as anyone, but if when one calls for political will, it's hard to know when it's there versus not. And that's my, I'm looking for things, well, seriously, like, is that a yes or a no, or blah, blah, blah. Whereas what I liked, and what when I've seen political leaders deliver, it's because someone has put a specific thing in front of them, that I call the yes proposition, that they have to say yes to. And so the question is, what's the practical set of things that we need to put in front of people and build a coalition that they have to say yes to? And I would argue, even on the nutrition side, I've talked with a lot of the people leading on the global nutrition efforts. I've said, you know, we have this great Lancet study, we have these great movements, great political recognition, but what are the top three things that need to get done for nutrition? What's the thing that you can tell a finance minister, fund X? Make sure these three things are in every line item of your budget. And I don't think we have enough clarity on that yet. And that's part of where we need to get, and I think where Feed the Future did a really good job, actually, is they translated into, these are the line items, these are the things, and this is what you're going to back. And then the politicians usually aren't doing the research themselves. They're, you know, reading the memo from the activist. And this gets to the final point on the role of science. So I've spent a lot of time in the global health debates over many years, and one of the things that's underappreciated is the role of the scientific community, especially the applied research community, with the debates taking place literally week in, week out, now day in, day out, in digital publishing, and the Lancet and the BMJ. And this is where much of the policy debate happens. It's with the academics and the academic practitioners saying, here's how to get a two-thirds reduction in child mortality. Then, no, here's how to get a two-thirds reduction in child mortality. No, their data are terrible. Here's what it really needs to be done. In most disciplines of global policymaking, we don't have that level of what I would call applied research rigor. And so with the CG system, it's doing a lot of the basic science. You know, what's the venue? Maybe it's food policy, maybe it's science, maybe it's nature, maybe it's a new journal, an e-journal, that Homi and I just contributed with Joaquin von Braun to this new kind of e-economics journal, focused on policy outcomes. But there needs to be a venue for all those scientists to be, I would argue, prompted to focus. What's the ROI on that scientific breakthrough? What's the scalable proposition on that breakthrough? What's the budget requirement of not just doing that for a project or a landscape, which is how a lot of agronomists are trained to think, but for a country or a district within the country or a province or a state or what have you? So I would really just urge everyone to look for and promote that kind of applied research, because those debates are what underpin the policymakers and the politicians to have political will and, or to deliver political will around things that work.
Thank you.
I agree on 2 points with John. One is on the political will. So let me start with that. I think, at least to the extent that it applies to the countries we looked at, there seems to be an interest in promoting agriculture and food security in general. I don't think that the issue is not this awareness from policymakers that we need to do something on agriculture, food security, and security. In fact, there's a lot of action going on in terms of designing strategy for nutrition policy, agriculture, productive safety net, social safety net. There are lots of action going on to the countries we closely looked at. The problem is maybe we're not too focused. We are dealing with, we're juggling with many things given the resource constraint. So one of the major challenges these governments face is the how to balance the equity aspect, how to address food security for the most vulnerable, at the same time promote productivity. So they're juggling. Given the resource constraint, I think that the issue should be how to focus and how to maintain the balance between equity and promoting economic growth in the agricultural sector. So I would say there is the awareness and the political will. Well, the resource, are there the resources there? It varies between different countries in terms of, so resources are one measure of maybe political will that we have looked at in this country. You mentioned also issues of land titling. So most of the countries we looked at, they seem to have a good policy, relatively good policy on access to productive inputs for agriculture in on paper. The challenge is how to implement them on the ground. And so land is a classic example. It's a political issue. The type of land rights these countries have is sometimes not to be touched. But so intermediate solution is land titling. For example, Ethiopia implemented a land certification program, and there are a number of studies showing that it improved agricultural productivity somehow and also off-farm employment. But it's a major challenge. Access to land is one of the major challenges these countries face. Though on paper, most governments acknowledge the importance of access to land.
Thank you. Well, I wanted to just leave you with the following thought. I mean, you know, we're dealing with these global challenges. The question is, you know, what does a place like the Brookings Institution have to do about all of this? So I would say when we started with this project, it was surprising to me to see how fragmented the information was that would allow one to have a reasonable conversation about these policies. Some of it is in FAO, some of it is in IFAD, some of it is in the World Bank, some of it is with the donors. Just putting together the aggregate numbers so that you can start to have a conversation about where are the needs and the results, what do the policies look like and what governments are doing for themselves, What are the resources that are going into these investments? That basic framing doesn't really exist. It doesn't exist for global hunger, and it doesn't exist for many of the other SDGs as well, with the possible exception of health, where there's been this sort of real explosion. So one of the things that we've been trying to do is to really encourage people to pay attention to the numbers. The data are not of high quality, and improving that, not just demanding more data, but improving the quality of the data is really fundamental. FAO have just revised their estimates of cereal yields in Côte d'Ivoire from something upwards of 3 and a bit tons per hectare to 2 and a bit tons per hectare. That's a one-third change. We can't navigate in this world if we are simply ignorant to with that order of magnitude of some really fundamental data. So I hope that by putting numbers together, by identifying the data gaps, by looking at the quality, and to be honest, by making some noise, we can keep drawing attention to this problem, because it does seem to me all of us need to do what we can to make some noise on this issue. Otherwise, we'll be sitting here in another 5 years' time. John will have far fewer hairs on his head because he'll have pulled them all out, and we'll be repeating the same thing. So thank you very much. Join me in thanking our panel.